I gotta kick this thing off. Can I kick it off? One, two, three, four.
What's going on, everybody? You know what time it is. If you guessed it's time for another episode of World History Class with Mr. Lutz, then you get a 5 on your AP World exam. It's that easy. Please make sure you read the disclaimer on the post regarding this claim. Anyway, today's episode is going to zoom in on the developments taking place in Mesoamerica and South America during Period 3. We're going to spend some time introducing some background information on the Aztecs and Incas, but ultimately we'll be spending most of our time discussing these two groups in particular. So, let's get ready to dig in and listen to me struggle with some pronunciation. Let's go. So, the biggest focus for us in the key concept connections with this chapter is going to be with key concept 3.2.1. which states empires collapsed in different regions of the world, and in some areas they were replaced by new imperial states or political systems. So particularly, we'll be discussing part D of that key concept. If you notice, I feel like it's each episode, I'm just getting a little bit more particular and particular with you, which I think ultimately makes your life easier. But anyway, part D of 3.2.1 says, in the Americas, as in Afro-Eurasia, state systems expanded in scope and reach, networks of city-states flourished in the Maya region, and at the end of this period, the imperial systems were created by the Mexica, otherwise known as the Aztecs, and the Inca. So we're going to begin today's episode with the Aztecs, but before we do that, I think it's important to discuss the geographic setting of central Mexico, which is where the Aztecs are ultimately going to be located, as well as the people who preceded the Aztecs, and that's going to be the people of Teotihuacan and the Toltecs. So this area where they kind of settle in the central valleys of Mexico is actually over a mile above sea level, and what it has in the area are several mountain lakes that are fed by runoff waters from the surrounding mountains. And so these rainwaters are going to help provide fertile soil, and they're going to help to complement the otherwise already rich resources that are located in this area. So to go back, we're going to start with a group called Teotihuacan. And at its high point, the city of Teotihuacan is believed to have been populated by anywhere from 150,000 to 200,000 citizens. And so the time period we're talking here with these people is going to be, their high point at least, is the 500s CE. So we're actually going back to period 2 when looking at these people. The city of Teotihuacan had apartments, elaborate temple complexes, palaces, markets, craft shops, stuff that maybe you might not have expected to hear at this point in the Americas, but nonetheless, they were there. And the heart of trade in Teotihuacan was centered on the exchange of obsidian. And I can't recall having mentioned obsidian in this podcast before, which is not a very good thing, if I'm going to be honest with you, because it made a huge difference in terms of weaponry prior to the Iron Age. What obsidian is exactly is it's a volcanic glass that's used not only for weaponry, but also for tools. And so if you have a monopoly on obsidian and your neighbors don't have iron goods and don't have access to obsidian, honestly speaking, you're going to have a leg up in terms of fighting. Otherwise, we don't really have much in the way of traditional historical sources when it comes to Teotihuacan, so we're forced to rely upon their works of art for information. So what we can learn from that type of stuff is that they're going to borrow and adapt certain features from their Olmec predecessors. One thing that I think is really interesting is literally called the Mesoamerican ball game. So it's a popular game that was prevalent during this time period. I actually found a YouTube link for you to check out that's going to show you kind of how it's played. It's really interesting. You know, in the like North America or in the Western world, quote unquote, think of a ball game, and I'm a soccer guy if you didn't know that. So like we're talking like kicking the ball with your feet or heading it, anything but your hands, unless you're the goalie, of course. Or we're talking games that you interact with the ball with your hands. this game, believe it or not, you play with your hips. So I'm just like, in my mind, I'm like, wow, this game would actually be like right up Shakira's alley. But yeah, you should check out the YouTube link. I'll post it in the description, and it's really interesting. And there's like a little bit of a resurgence going on in Mexico, where there's a couple of local groups who are really trying to invest in the sport and spread it in local communities, and even hoping to make it a professional sport. But other than that, from the Olmecs, they're also borrowing some concepts as part of their calendar and their writing system. And so what's going to bring Teotihuacan down is going to be some outside invaders that lead to the decline of their city and its eventual collapse. Honestly speaking, by 750 CE, so the earliest part of Period 3, Teotihuacan is virtually destroyed and really is no longer in center stage in central Mexico. Now, by the 10th century, the next important group that's going to emerge is called the Toltecs. And the Toltecs are going to be extremely militaristic in nature. They're going to expand their territory through warfare and also through valuing human sacrifice as a way to appease their gods. And, you know, maybe a little bit of a tangent here. I'm going to come back to this, I think, a little bit later on. This whole idea of sacrifice, when we talk about it that way, there's images that are conjured up in our head of, you know, like the temple priest up on top of the temple, plunging the knife into like the chest of the guy he's sacrificing. It's this brutal, gory thing, and blood's running down and streaming everywhere. But what I need you guys to understand is during a lot of the warfare that existed between these groups that practiced ritual human sacrifice, the objective on the battlefield was not to slaughter as many of your opponents as possible. It's actually to capture people to then offer up for sacrifice. So we could take this concept of sacrifice and think of it in the narrow concept or the narrow constraints of what it looks like in Central America and Mexico. Or we could view the concept of soldiers fighting on a battlefield and being killed on said battlefield as sacrificing themselves for the betterment of the nation. So it's really all on how you define that word sacrifice. So anyway, a little bit of a tangent there. Sorry, I just want to come back to the Toltecs again. I just heard that on one of those BBC In Our History episodes, and I thought that was a really good point that was worth sharing with you guys. So anyway, what feeds the Toltec people are going to be irrigated canals that help people to grow food such as maize, and beans, peppers, tomatoes, and really can sustain people, agriculturally speaking. And their capital city, Tula, is able to grow wealthy because the people who they conquer are going to be forced to pay tribute. And also, too, the Toltecs have a very strong and large presence in the pottery and obsidian trade as well, just like their Teotihuacan predecessors. Much like those same predecessors, the Toltecs are going to be brought down by instability throughout the empire, which was caused by nomadic groups coming from the north. And one of those nomadic groups who will move in more so after the collapse of the Toltecs are going to be our focus in this region for this episode, and that is the Aztecs, sometimes known as the Mexica or the Mexica. And they're going to make their way into central Mexico by the 1200 CE. And by 1325, they're going to settle on an island in the middle of Lake Texcoco and establish the city known as Tenochtitlan. So in Tenochtitlan, the Aztecs are able to take advantage of the abundant supply of fish, and they're able to utilize what is called, and this is also something in the key concepts. So let me pause it, and I'll come right back with which specific one it is for you. And I'm back to let you know that it was key concept 3.3.1.A, where you will see chinampas mentioned. And so what chinampas are, it's a system that allows the Aztecs to take mud from the bottom of the lake in order to form these small floating islands on which they can grow maize, beans, squash, among other vegetables. And the soil that they're going to use is so rich that it allows the Aztecs to yield several harvests throughout the same growing season, which is obviously going to allow for abundant agricultural supply. And so by 1500, the Aztecs are going to develop an empire throughout central Mexico, and it is going to span in that region from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast. And how this is able to happen is the empire is functioning thanks to the Aztecs colonizing the lands that they conquer. So taking some of their most loyal subjects and moving them into the regions that are newly conquered, and also forging what's known as the Triple Alliance with the cities of Texcoco and Tlacopan. I'm so proud of my pronunciation. You have no idea. That was first try, everybody. And that allows them to manage the distant reaches of their empire that was approximately populated by probably about 12 million people during its height. And so how the Aztecs can kind of succeed and thrive is they focus their energy on taxing and collecting tribute from their conquered subjects. So this tribute could be paid in the form of food, or it could be goods. So we're talking for that clothing, gold, cotton fabric, jewelry, and that really helps them. So you might wonder, how can they get all of this tribute? Are they extending their bureaucracy and their army everywhere? Because think about in the past that we've learned, you know, when you overextend your empire and you've got such a large bureaucracy to sustain and such a large military to sustain, that can lead to an overextending of resources and can mean trouble. But actually, this system's not facilitated by a bureaucracy. It's facilitated by the conquered people themselves. And also, the Aztecs do not maintain a garrison of troops throughout the regions they control. So naturally, I'm sure you're wondering, how in the world do you make this work? How in the world do you get people to fall in line? And I'm sure you can guess the answer. It's through fear. Fear-based tactics is really what's going to command the loyalty of the conquered peoples to the Aztecs. So if subjects step out of line, they could be captured or they could be slaughtered to serve as an example for the rest of the empire subjects. And that's really what's going to keep a hold on these populations that the Aztecs will be conquering. So in terms of Aztec social organization, you're going to have the king on top of this social class pyramid who's seen as a god on earth. And that king is going to be supported by his military leaders, who often could obtain their high status through acts of valor on the battlefield that are going to be really highly regarded. The nobility, who could be made up of priests and government officials who also hold significant power in society. And often these nobles are going to be the ones who own large amounts of land, and they receive lots of tribute from those who lived and worked on their land, and they're able to economically benefit solely off of their status and land ownership. Aztec priests receive a lot of respect and honor in society because it's ultimately them who are seen as the individuals who could link the gods to the people and help keep the divine, the higher beings, in favor of their society. And these priests would also serve as the advisors to the Aztec kings as well. In terms of gender relations, women within the home, at least, hold a relatively equal status to men in that regard, but they're not going to have influence really in terms of the political or the military realms of society. I've seen conflicting reports on this, but to my knowledge, women could not inherit property, and this has been agreed upon, that above all else, women are thought of as homemakers. But within that capacity as a homemaker, their status is really highly regarded because they're going to bear the children who will ultimately serve as the warriors for society, and they could also be extremely influential in terms of trade as well. So Aztec social organization at a more like local and immediate level is going to typically be characterized by living in what are called the Calpulli. And the Calpulli is originally based upon these groups of people who share one thing in common above all else, and that is descent from a common ancestor. However, over time, Calpulli becomes defined by groups of families simply living and working together. And the Calpulli are expected to offer tribute ultimately to the state, and that tribute is then going to be distributed to the nobility and also into grain storage in case there's ever threat of drought or famine. And to just let you know, you guys can mark down in your scorebooks, that's the first time that I've had to do a Google search on how to correctly pronounce Kalpulli, which to my knowledge, I think I did so far okay. I'm going to go B+ on my pronunciation. I'll let you guys let me know what you think in class when I see you. So aside from the Mesoamerican ballgame and the calendar, which I had mentioned all the way back with the people of Teotihuacan, the Aztecs not only adopt those things as well, but they also take on the religious traits of previous Mesoamerican groups. They're going to adopt the gods of from the people of Teotihuacan, as well as bloodletting and sacrifice. But it's going to be their belief that blood had given the earth what it needed in order for crops to grow. And so sacrificial victims can continue to provide that blood to sustain the bountiful harvest of these people. And the Aztecs are definitely going to ramp up sacrifice into larger numbers than had been seen in previous groups in central Mexico. So for now, we're going to move our attention and head it towards the south, across the Andes Mountains, and into the territory that was controlled by the Inca. And like their brethren to the north in central Mexico, the Inca are going to forge a path in history that's going to be originally cut by earlier groups, some including the Chavín, Moche, and the Nazca people in South America. By the way, chalk that up as number 2 for Chavín and number 3 for Moche in terms of YouTube searches on how to correctly pronounce. I was kind of confident, but I know this is going out to an audience larger than my students, so I wanted to make sure I had my bases covered. I'm still feeling good. But anyway, the people who are going to be known as the Incas are going to first establish their own kingdom in the 1200s in what is the Valley of Cuzco, which is eventually going to become their capital city as well. And when Pachacuti takes the throne in 1438, the Inca are going to begin a campaign which will see them take the lands of their neighbors. And Pachacuti helps to build up the military strength of the Inca, but how he really makes this empire succeed is not through military strength so much as it's through diplomacy to build up stronger relationships with the people they take control of. And he's only going to use force when it's absolutely necessary. Pachacuti is also going to be responsible for helping to develop systems of taxation, of grain storage, especially road networks to help facilitate travel in the empire. And those road networks are worth kind of stopping and talking about for a minute. They are going to typically be north-south, two roads, one that kind of runs through the mountains, one that kind of runs more along the coast, and they're going to stretch over 10,000 miles, and they're going to obviously help facilitate not only goods, but more importantly, soldiers, news, and the beliefs of the Incas throughout the entire north-south length of their empire. This region, generally speaking, had relied upon harvesting potatoes and herding llamas and alpacas, and these animals are going to be so important in the early history of the Americas prior to Columbian contact. We'll get to the Columbian Exchange later on in history and how important it is, but for right now, if you stop and think about it, these are their largest, domesticated animals that they have in the Americas prior to European contact. So they're going to be the animals that provide the peoples of South America with wool, with dung for fuel and for meat. I don't know. I can never stop thinking about this. If you guys recall the Geico commercial with Marco Polo from like several years ago, and there's a llama in the video or in the commercial, that's actually, if we're going to get technical, it's historically inaccurate because Marco Polo lived prior to Columbus, and llamas would have never made their way into Eurasia prior to the times of Columbus. So you guys can get out your history magnifying glass and critique Geico all you want for their historical inaccuracies. I don't know, maybe we start a letter writing campaign for extra credit or something. Just spitballing ideas here. So anyway, let me get back to what you guys are actually listening to this for, which is information about what you're reading. Economically, there's not going to be much of a presence in trade among the Incas, especially when compared to the Aztecs. Long-distance trade is controlled by the state. So as a result, there's not this independent class of merchants that are going to help continually facilitate long-distance exchanges. You have, in comparison with the Aztecs, professional long distance merchants called Pochteca, who are going to help not only trade, but also they're going to help provide information to the central government about the places they travel. They're going to communicate information from the state to the far reaches of the empire and be really important in terms of that connection. But back to the Incas, there is a similarity, economically at least, and that's more in terms of agriculture. So the peasants of Inca society are going to live in what were called Ayllu, which is really similar to the Aztec Calpulli. Labor, tools, food, among other things, are going to be shared among the families of the Ayllu. And peasants are also going to be required to not only work their own land for their own benefit, but they also work the land of the state. And the harvests from these lands are going to benefit sometimes the upper classes, or they go into storage. So there's this state-run land that gets managed separately from the Ayllu. And this system of state-required labor, basically, is going to be known as the Mita, and it's going to return in a similar form again when we start talking about Spanish conquest in South America. And the Mita system is going to call upon the labor of its citizens, not only for farming, but also to construct new buildings, to build or to repair roads, or to just produce goods for the state. Culturally speaking, there's some differences regarding language, but there's several similarities between the religions of the Aztecs and the Inca. So the Incas don't have a system of writing that we would typically associate with a group like the Aztecs, but they do use something called quipu, which is this system of knotting cords that's going to help them keep track of information. I think what I'll do also on top of that Mesoamerican ball game video, I'll post one on what quipu is exactly, because it's kind of interesting. It's kind of cool. I don't have much time to devote to an explanation here, but there's like a 3-minute video I think National Geographic does that kind of lets you know how this system works. By the way, should go on to mention, before I get too sucked into these things, a lot of the stuff that I'm mentioning here between the Mita and quipu, Key Concept 3.1.3 C and D is where some of this stuff ties in. I just wanted to throw that in there before I got too far ahead of myself. Aztecs, on the other hand, they're going to use a system of pictographs that help them keep track of things like business transactions, tax records, family histories, prophecies, among other things. Similarity, though, religiously, the Aztecs and the Incas are both polytheistic, and they give significant prominence to the priests of their respective societies because they play such a prominent role in the religious ceremonies. And the Incas also make sacrifices to their gods, but typically this is not going to be human sacrifice. It's usually animals or agricultural goods to keep the gods in their favor. So for our zooming in feature, I don't want to spend tons of time with this, but I wanted to make mention of it because the next time we hear about the Aztecs and Incas, it's going to be in focus of how it relates to European contact in the Americas. And we're going to talk about this idea of like what allowed for the Europeans to be able to overtake, particularly the Spanish, of course, to overtake the Aztecs and the Incas. And there's a historian that we'll talk about. No names yet. We're not going to get there because we're going to do a little bit of mudslinging later on. But the common belief is just European weapons and European diseases and European this and European that makes all the difference. And it's not wrong per se, but it's incomplete. What's missing in that equation is that we can't just chalk all of this up to just European factors. There are factors in Aztec society and in Inca society that help quicken the pace of imperial decline, especially when you have a power like the Spanish, as well as the diseases and the weapons that they bring with them that really help bring an end to these two empires. For the Aztecs, there's a lot of mention in your book about this increasingly large growth of the nobility and the tension that this creates on the social class structure. And we also need to keep in mind that the terror policies they have, their tribute system, those are never really
long-term successful strategies to maintain hold of an empire. And so it's going to lead to the collapse of central authority, especially when people who are dissatisfied and frustrated and flat out sick of Aztec imperial rule are going to make alliances with the Spanish in opposition against the Aztecs. And that's going to really help drive them to their demise, among other things. You know, it is absolutely fair to say the Europeans have things going in their favor, but we can't discredit what's going against the favor of the Aztecs at this time. For the Incas, your book talks about this concept of split inheritance, where basically the successor to the throne gets the political control, but the children of the prior emperor get the wealth, get the property of the emperor. So what this leads to then is the next emperor is going to use his military resources to further extend the power, to get more wealth for his own particular purposes. And so this is just this self-sustaining, perpetual conquest for more and more and more and more, which, my goodness, how many times have we seen this so far this year? You're going to overstretch imperial control. You're going to have difficulty with nomadic groups. Like, if these people would just look at history, they would figure out how to overcome these problems. But when have we ever learned from history? I don't know. Hopefully soon. One day we'll get it. But royal marriages also help establish alliances throughout the Incas and their groups that they're associating themselves with. But it also creates court rivalries, and it leads to disunity in the capital and almost leads to civil war just prior to European contact. So both of these empires have problems at home, let alone the problems that emerge into their backyard, beginning with the Spanish making their way into the region in the late 15th and 16th centuries. We have to understand both in order to have a fuller picture of what exactly brought these two groups down. So in the explainer for today's episode, I just wanted to point your attention to one particular part of your chapter, and that's the section called Aztecs and Incas. And quite frankly, I don't have the book in front of me right now. I don't know the page number. It's where it says Aztecs and Incas. Look, and when you see that, you'll know you're in the right place. Sorry, it's late. Anyway, what you want to do here is obviously read over it. Duh. But focus on the word choice that Peter Stearns uses. And I think that it's really helpful to see how he is writing. Some of those that say, you know, that start with the word although are going to address the similarities and the differences. So, you know, although the Aztecs and Incas have similarities in terms of blank, they also have blank. You know, then you're going to be getting into the differences. And I think that that's a good help in terms of what good writing in terms of style can look like. Pay attention also, though, to what the similarities and differences are exactly, and think back and ask what kind of evidence comes from the chapter that support it. Because you're going to find, and you should keep track of, there's going to be some claims that he makes where there's poorly substantiated evidence as well. You know, so as you're reading this, like, think in your mind, what kind of a grade would you give him? Does Stearns provide analysis that explains why these differences and similarities exist? Is he providing evidence that justifies that these claims are in fact truthful? I think in terms of, like, thinking about your reading assignments as examples of good writing or not helps you guys to see and understand how you can become better writers. And I think that's just a good piece of information with every reading you get this year. Approach it in terms of, is this doing what I need to do? Because if it's not, like, we should call it out for what it is or what it is not. So So the last thing for today's recommendation is going to be this interactive timeline from a website called Sutori on the Aztec, the Inca, and the Maya. And again, of course, I'll provide this link in the episode description, but it just does kind of a good job of giving you a chronological rundown of those three groups, the Aztec, the Inca, and the Maya. And it includes in it different YouTube videos. For instance, the Mesoamerican ballgame video comes into here. It has some quiz questions distributed throughout, and they're kind of like lower level quiz questions. It's nothing like that's primary sourced or secondary source based. It's just like, hey, are you retaining the stuff that you're checking out as you read through this? And I think it just, it organizes it really well. Like if you're someone who needs more visuals and needs to look at a source that forces you to reckon and consider the information as you're reading it, I think that this tutorial website's actually a really cool thing to check out. And to my knowledge, I'll have to look back at this. There's a lot more topics that we cover in class where they have these timelines built out that you can actually use as a way to review and kind of process the information as you're reading it or hearing it here on the podcast. So yeah, I'm hitting that 30-minute mark that I usually hit, surprisingly. I don't know how that happens. It just does, so we'll just go with it. Hopefully my ramblings in this episode don't throw you off too much. Hopefully my pronunciation was decent. My fingers are crossed on that one. Yeah, I think I'm done for today. So hopefully you guys found that one to be helpful. As always, let me know if you guys have questions or anything that you need help with further understanding, whether it's resource period, email, Schoology, Twitter, I don't know, whatever it is you kids are doing these days. But yeah, that's it for today. So until next time, I will talk to you later. Take care, everyone.